We are back with a new and fresh episode of The Far Middle. Yeah, I'm emphasizing the new and the fresh today, considering that we are in the middle now of another long, dreary winter. Winter for me has always been about timing. When it first starts, you know, you've got Christmas and New Year's to look forward to. The first falling of snow is something that's neat. You forgot about snow from the prior winter. But then, you know, the holidays pass and the snow, it starts to get old and you start to miss warmth and daylight and sunshine. That's basically mid-January through the end of probably March in most parts of the northern United States. So we've got a long way to go before we get to spring. And I'm hoping that The Far Middle, with a fresh new episode each week, is going to help you, constant listener, get through the dreariness of the back end of winter. We are at episode 87 of The Far Middle, and the dedication is going to be pretty straightforward. Not surprisingly, episode 87 is dedicated to Sidney Crosby. And everyone knows that Crosby epitomizes greatness on the ice, but what are some of the major reasons as to why he's great? Well, we can tick them off. And there are going to be three big fundamental drivers. The first is that he might be, I think he is, the best all-around, or what hockey experts refer to as a complete 200-foot game player that the NHL has ever seen. Now, there may have been better pure goal scorers, and there may have been better defensive specialists or faster skaters or better puck handlers, but when you roll all those attributes together, there's never been a more complete player from one end of the ice to the other, thus the 200-foot reference than you'll find with Sidney Crosby. And the second fundamental reason as to why Crosby is great, it speaks to his leadership. And I know there's a lot of fans from different cities that don't care for Crosby. That's going to be true of just about any superstar in a competitive sport or league. But no one questions Sidney Crosby's commitment to leadership and how he sets the tone and the standard for his teammates. He is dedicated and he leads by example. And then the third fundamental driver of his greatness, it really goes to the simple fact that he's a winner. And he's a winner across any imaginable standard or metric that you can think of. So, you know, has he won Stanley Cups? Yeah, three of them to be exact. He's won a gold medal in the Olympics for Team Canada. In fact, he scored the game-winning goal against the United States at the Vancouver Olympics. He's won every imaginable individual award in the NHL, you know, from MVP of the regular season to MVP of the Stanley Cup playoffs and everything else in between. But I will say, ironically, the only individual award that I know of that he did not win so far has been the Selke Award. That goes to the best defensive forward in the game. And I say that's ironic because I think one of the best aspects of his game has been his defensive play. So it's sort of ironic he hasn't won an award that actually speaks to one of his strengths. Now, there are other contributors to Crosby's greatness besides those big three. You know, he's been very resilient. He's overcome numerous concussions. He plays hurt. He's navigated through the ups and downs of different team lineups through the years. He's at the same time boringly and also scarily consistent. So how consistent he's been through the years, it's scary and it's boring at the same time. We take it for granted. And his statistics, when you look at them, they're reflecting his greatness. And if he keeps playing at his current pace for a few more years, he's likely going to finish in the top 10 all time for career points. And he might actually have a chance of cracking the top five. By the way, it's pretty interesting to me to see that Ovechkin and Crosby, two all-time great contemporaries of one another, right? They're neck and neck in career points as we speak. So they're really close together in terms of overall career points, which is ironic and very fitting. But you know, goals and point totals, they aren't the first priority of Crosby. Winning is his top priority. And at least currently, that's what sets him apart from a great talent like Connor McDavid. You know, Connor McDavid might have more pure talent, but he's yet to establish his ability to win. McDavid, he'll tally more points than Crosby, but Crosby's accomplished more when it comes to the ultimate objective of playing in the NHL, which of course is hoisting the Stanley Cup over your head. Now, how great is Sidney Crosby? Now, specifically, when you compare him across all generations of the greats, is he on the Mount Rushmore of hockey? I think we talked about this issue in a prior episode of The Far Middle. It is a tough call. So for sure, I think three of those four faces on Mount Rushmore are going to be Gretzky, Lemieux, and Orr. I would not even consider not having those three up there. But then who is the fourth face? That's where it gets really interesting. One could argue Gordie Howe. One might say Ovechkin. And someone else could objectively argue Crosby. I have to go with Ovechkin. It's a bit painful for me saying that, being a Penguins fan. But you've got to consider the fact that he's chasing and looks like he might actually catch Gretzky on the all-time goal list. And although he doesn't have the complete game that Crosby has, Ovechkin does have amazing durability, and he plays a very physical game. But if you want to put Crosby up there, or instead say Gordie Howe, you go right ahead. I don't think anyone's going to call you crazy. I certainly won't. Let's get rolling with our connections for episode 87. We talked about all-time greats in the world of hockey, and when you're an all-time great and your career is spanning years, and in some instances decades, you start to accumulate points. And it's the topic of accumulation that I want to speak to on our next dot to connect to. And that is in the context not of hockey and point totals, but instead in the context of government budgets and what's going on with the federal debt load. We've got a scary trifecta that this nation is facing when it comes to our fiscal health. So first, the current magnitude of the federal debt is a staggering $31+ trillion, and it's growing at an astonishing rate. I know the United States federal government is massive, and I realize that the U.S. dollar is the fiat currency for the planet. But when a debt load is sitting at over $31 trillion, that's going to be a massive problem for anyone or anything, and it's just a matter of time before the problem manifests its ugly head. Second part of the scary trifecta, our government, whether it be Congress or the executive branch, it continues to outspend what it takes in. And that produces a gargantuan deficit each and every year, which then necessarily gets added to the already massive debt load of the $31+ trillion. Congress and the president, they still can't seem to figure out that you should not spend more than what you take in over extended periods of time. The Senate can't figure it out. The House of Representatives can't figure it out. President can't figure it out. Republicans have failed to do so, and Democrats have failed to do so. There is no party or branch of government which seems to understand the most fundamental rule of finance, which is you can't run deficits forever. Third piece of the scary trifecta, the era of free money and grossly negative real interest rates, it's over. Inflation is raging all across the planet and across every imaginable category. As we discussed extensively on the Far Middle, inflation has been manufactured in large part by government and state intervention and their policies, particularly when it comes to energy policy and climate policy and monetary policy. But now that inflation is loose, it's going to have to be tamed. And the only way to tame it is for central banks like the Federal Reserve to start raising interest rates. And although the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates quite a bit in the past year, it's got a substantial ways to go. Because to tame inflation, you have to have interest rates set at a level above where inflation is sitting at. We're not there yet, and we're far from getting there. But when you raise interest rates and you couple it with a debt load of over $31 trillion, you're going to quickly realize that more and more of our annual government expenditures are going towards servicing that debt and paying the interest bill on that debt, which means either you have to cut spending drastically elsewhere across the federal budget, or you end up running even larger deficits, which then lead to even larger federal debt loads, which leads to even more massive debt service costs. It's a vicious cycle without fiscal discipline, and that is sure to come to an abrupt halt once the capital markets realize what is occurring. That's, as I said, the scary trifecta of accumulation that's occurring with government finances. Budget deficits grow, debt servicing costs grow with higher interest rates, and total government debt grows, to the point where the accumulation of all three result in a serious math problem that does not compute. Which leads us to a related connection to make. Do we see any of this dynamic of the scary trifecta showing up in tangible financial metrics? Well, the answer is yes. We are starting to see the scary trifecta manifest in measurable financial metrics. Our Treasury Department reported that interest paid on the public debt toward the end of 2022 was up almost 90% compared to the October and November period of the prior year. That means that interest costs could add almost $250 billion to the federal government's budget deficit in fiscal year 2023. Congress in December of last year passed a $1.7 trillion omnibus bill, remember that? And that ran over 4,000 pages in length, and that is going to surely result in another annual deficit and add to the $31 trillion+ in federal debt. Federal spending, it remains significantly higher than the levels were of federal spending before pandemic. In stretching this progression of connections to one further dot, I suspect the federal budget deficit is going to end up being even larger than what is currently projected by economists and government bureaucrats. And that's not necessarily because of the gargantuan spending that we just discussed and things like the omnibus bill. Sure, those things are bad enough, but there's also a concern that I have with respect to tax revenue inflows dropping off compared to what they were in recent years. Most people don't realize that tax revenues for the federal government are close to the highest levels in the history of the United States, almost 20% of GDP. But, you know, with the recent stock market sell-off and the volatility in the market, along with the dried-up IPO market, coupled with all kinds of layoffs in the job sector, you can be sure the federal tax revenues are going to start to drop off, and that's going to make government deficits larger, which will make the federal debt higher, which will make the debt servicing costs at higher interest rates worse. So that will be another tangible metric, that being tax revenues, that we should pay close attention to in 2023 to see how this scary trifecta might play out either worse or quicker than expected. Yeah, it's sobering stuff for sure. Makes you wonder how even the federal government is able to spend so much money and to run up such gargantuan deficits. The magnitude of these numbers, when you're measuring them in the trillions, it makes that feat hard to fathom, even for a monster as big as the federal government. But thinking about it, those lead us nicely into our next connection. The ability of government to spend and outspend to the level that it does, it rests largely on government's ability to constantly be extending its tentacles into all facets of economy and society. Government spends endless amounts of money, not just to help the poor or to right a wrong, but now also to save the planet. So tackling climate change has been a boom for big government, which is one of the drivers and tactics that you use to rack up unfathomable levels of spending and deficit. Part of the game plan to tackle climate change, of course, is to mandate and to subsidize electric vehicles, EVs. The assumption is EVs are zero emissions and they don't have a carbon footprint, which of course is absurd and non-scientific, but nevertheless, that's the justification. And once government has justification for subsidizing something that's going to tackle climate change and save the planet, there's no telling where the spending excess may end. I was reminded of this reading an article about General Motors. The company was discussing its strategy when it came to electric vehicles and how it planned to make a profit off of EVs. General Motors said it expected to be profitable with EVs in North America by 2025. Why? And why was General Motors confident in this? Well, the number one reason was new federal subsidies that Congress and our president enacted in 2022 to, you know, tackle climate change and save the planet. The quote from the article that I took notice of that came from the GM CEO was an interesting one. She said, quote, "We believe we are better positioned than nearly all of our competitors because we are so far along on that journey in every respect," end quote. Now, that is an endorsement not of the competitive prowess of General Motors or the quality of their product, but instead an endorsement of being strategically positioned to maximize the timing and amount of corporate graft that General Motors can draw from government, which means that GM has built their business model and profitability on the ability to draw subsidy from government. That's billions of dollars being directed by government to go from the pockets of middle-class taxpayers into the coffers of multi-billion dollar global corporations. But thankfully, that's a price worth paying because, you know, it's going to tackle climate change and save the planet. Yeah, right. Yes, governments and corporations and politicians, you know, they've all learned that virtue signaling can be a powerful cover and marketing technique to justify graft on epic scales. At least GM is a legitimate business, albeit now it's employing a business strategy that relies on the mysticism of tackling climate change. But, you know, it could be worse. And in some instances, we see situations that are much worse. And that is the topic of our next connection, which is the disaster that is known as FTX. So the founder of this crypto sham, FTX, his name is Sam Bankman-Fried, and he built a complete sham business, albeit it was marketed in a way to attract and at the same time to dupe investors to the tune of billions and billions of dollars. So how did he do it? And how did FTX pull this off? I thought, you know, the capital markets were sophisticated, and I thought investors should be able to smell out this type of fraud. Well, the primary tactic that FTX and its founder utilized was the virtue signaling of ESG. The company promised to be carbon neutral. It funded a foundation whose mission was to provide solar energy to the Amazon River Basin. The founder, Bankman-Fried, conducted numerous interviews across mainstream media, including my favorite interview, where he was interviewed by none other than Gisele Bündchen, the Brazilian supermodel. It's a fact. And the company and its founder also curried favor with politicians and regulators. And an ESG ratings company, which I think, depending on the ESG ratings firm, can be a seriously flawed endeavor. But this ratings firm for ESG went so far to grade FTX higher on the category of leadership and governance than the firm graded ExxonMobil, believe it or not. So this was a company, FTX that is, that at the time had a board of directors that consisted of three individuals, one being the founder, Bankman-Fried, another one being a company executive, so another insider, and a third being an outsider. So you might want to find out who that ESG rating firm was that assigned that grade. I'm not going to name it here, but make sure that your investment portfolio is not following any of its other grades for other companies, because what they did here is beyond negligence. And what's amazing about all this is that everyone, including these types of companies and their leaders and the ratings firms for ESG and the regulators, they all know that this can become quite the sham if it's abused. That is ESG and virtue signaling when they're abused. Bankman-Fried himself said it best with, quote, "ESG has been perverted beyond recognition. This dumb game we woke Westerners play, where we say all the right shibboleths so that everybody likes us," end quote. So FTX, its history, and its founders facing criminal charges, but the broader game of manipulating ESG and virtue signaling to engage in graft, to curry favor, and to, in some instances, defraud, that game continues on bigger than ever. But you know, we can jump to another topic or connection that gives us hope when it comes to the virtue signaling in ESG gone awry. Vanguard. It's the second largest investment manager in the world, and you probably are invested in some of its products if you've got an index mutual fund or a 401k. Now, Vanguard and other investment managers like it joined a coalition that was created out of virtue signaling and things like ESG and tackling climate change. That coalition is known as the Net Zero Asset Managers Initiative, or NZAM for short. And there's another one, a similar coalition, that's known as the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, or GFANZ. Now, these two organizations, they were created out of the virtue signaling of decarbonizing the global economy to once again tackle climate change. And what the organizations attempt to do is to get banks and insurance companies and financial institutions like Vanguard to sign on to the group, which then requires the institutions to adhere to the organization's climate mission. And that ultimately is designed to try to starve industries like natural gas from investment in capital markets and to feed or subsidize industries like wind, solar, or EVs with investment from the capital markets above and beyond the level of investment those industries would normally attract based on their own competitiveness and metrics. It's a great example of why GM has built its new business strategy along the lines of EV subsidy and how entities like FTX can get away with what they got away with before the music stops and the game is up. Now, the reason numerous financial institutions signed up for these types of organizations is that there was pressure to do so. It was virtue signaling. It was showing that you were a climate warrior like everybody else, and it curried favor with those in power, whether they be political or regulatory or the expert class. And it was viewed, frankly, as good business practice. But then other stakeholders started to question what an index fund had to do with climate change. In other words, an index fund exists to have a singular goal to maximize the long-term returns to help their clients attain a more secure financial future. An index fund, like the ones offered by Vanguard, they don't exist to curry favor with one side of the political spectrum or even to tackle climate change. Vanguard, they woke up to that reality, pun intended, I suppose, and they decided to withdraw from the two organizations that I just mentioned. And the decision by Vanguard, you know, beyond being something that should be applauded, it's the right decision in the context of the mission of Vanguard. It's also, I think, a reaffirmation of what Milton Friedman taught us. Friedman taught us that the role of business in a capitalistic economy is to maximize profits for its ownership. Vanguard took Milton Friedman's doctrine and boiled it down and customized it for the mission of an index fund, which once again is to maximize the long-term returns to help its clients attain a more secure financial future. So, there is hope, constant listeners. For every Sam Bankman-Fried, there is a Milton Friedman, For every corporate business model built off a graft, there is another business that's figured things out and has course corrected its mission. And for every hollow virtue signaling abuse of ESG doctrine, there's a legitimate and effective application of ESG to observe. We just need to be willing to celebrate and promote the positives and those who get it right while holding accountable and daylighting the entities who are abusing the concepts and getting them very wrong. Yes, strategy and tactics, they matter. They matter in business and in geopolitics. And virtue signaling and graft seeking, they often cloud the good from the bad when it comes to strategy and tactics. And I was reminded of that recently when I stumbled upon a story about French President Macron discussing how he supported a strategy of the absolute defense of the Ukraine. That's using his words, absolute defense of the Ukraine. Now, it was great to hear that from the French president, and that can serve as our next connection, because I started thinking about what he said. And then on top of it, I started to think about what France has done tactically over the past number of years and how that compares to the French president's view of the strategic absolute defense of the Ukraine. The two simply don't mesh. What has France done over the past 10 years? Well, it instituted a nationwide ban on fracking, which removed any ability of France to produce its own domestic natural gas. Then it mandated a reliance on wind and solar, which have proven to not be scalable at anywhere close to the level and speed needed to meet the mandate targets, which then led to an inevitable reliance on Russian natural gas. Now, these were the actions of France that need to be compared to and contrasted with the words of France's leader, because none of those actions did anything to support Ukraine then or now. In fact, all of those actions by France, they hurt Ukraine. Then, the actions enabled Putin to have the confidence to invade, and today, those actions continue to give Putin hope that time's on his side and to see the invasion through instead of settling for peace and withdrawing. Ukraine's biggest adversary, it may end up not being Putin or Russia or the Wagner Group, as bad as they are. They're certainly bad enough, but the biggest adversary may end up being these climate policies and the tactical moves underneath them that Western European nations and the United States are embarking on. No climate policies, I think maybe no invasion of Ukraine. Reversal of climate policies, I think Putin gives up hope and he knows that the game is up and the war is over. But until things change, France's actions, they're all that Putin needs to see to continue on with the fight. In France's words, they're about, you know, that strategy of the absolute defense of Ukraine. They're nothing but hollow musings. You know, sometimes they just drive you crazy. But you know, words are not always just hollow musings. Sometimes words matter greatly and to the great benefit of mankind. It all depends on the speaker and on the message. No better example of this than where we can end our episode 87 with, which is a mini dedication to someone who celebrated a birthday a few days ago, one of the greatest orators of the past 100 years, and certainly in the nation's history. That, of course, is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. MLK, he was a master at the written word and obviously with the spoken word as well. You could learn just about anything you need to learn about advocacy and swaying people's minds by just giving a read through the library of Martin Luther King's work. Most consider, of course, his best effort to be the I Have a Dream speech that was delivered on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. back in the summer of 1963. I'm not going to argue with that one for sure, but if you want a little inspiration in the vein of Martin Luther King, I've got two suggestions for you to close out episode 87 with. First, if you're ever in Memphis, you have to check out the National Civil Rights Museum. It's attached to and built around part of the Lorraine Motel where Martin Luther King was struck down. And the museum is an amazing institution. Doesn't matter what your walk of life is or what your status or persuasion is. You spend half a day at the Civil Rights Museum and it will get you thinking about a whole bunch of matters on a much grander scale. Second, the next time you get down to our nation's capital, check out on one end of Pennsylvania Avenue, the hotel that's got more history packed within it than some museums do. And that is the Willard Hotel, close to the White House. It has all kinds of history. Henry Clay, way back when, he introduced the mint julep for the first time outside of Kentucky at the bar in the Willard, and that's why it's the official drink of the Willard to this day. President Grant, he would smoke a cigar and drink brandy in the lobby of the Willard, and when he did so, all kinds of promoters and individuals would approach him with different business ventures and propositions. And he started to get annoyed with it, and he gave a name to these people. He ended up calling them lobbyists because of where he always found them, in a lobby of the Willard Hotel. And hence, an industry was created, and the country hasn't been the same since. In tying back to Martin Luther King, he and his advisors, they huddled in the lobby of the Willard to make the final edits to his I Have a Dream speech, just hours before he delivered it, again on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, back in 1963. Yeah, you don't need half a day, but if you've got 10 or 15 minutes while in D.C., stop by the Willard and walk through the lobby. You'll feel the history, and you might hear some of those ghosts from the past. Now, one of my favorite MLK quotes is, quote, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter," end quote. In many ways, the thought behind the far middle, I'd like to think. I hope you have a wonderful and productive week, and we shall meet again for episode 88.